From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at Central Michigan University, where a student named Simba was struggling academically away from his parents. The sophomore felt free to do what he wanted, party, play video games, and ignore his schoolwork if he wanted. Even though he knew he was avoiding his academic responsibilities, Simba didn't see the connection between his choices and his failing grades. That was the case until he joined a mentoring program called Men About Change. Each week, he attended sessions with about 60 other young men to learn about financial responsibility, toxic masculinity, and how to prioritize goals, goals that included improving his grades. With that positive mentorship, Simba got back on track and even became a resident assistant at the university. Talking about the program, he said, quote, "Every time I walk out of that room, I just feel fired up to be great. I just walk out of there with fire in my heart, fire in my chest, fire in my brain." Facilitator Stuart and I had a conversation about success, and he said, "I can succeed, so I'm going to do it," end quote. Mentorship is just one solution that can help boys and young men of color realize their potential and goals, and it's a key component of an upcoming conference in Rochester aiming at improving the success rates of young male students of color. It's called the Rochester Boys and Men of Color Education Summit, and it's set for this Saturday. We're going to get a preview of that conference this hour with our guests, who will discuss representation in schools and the community, culturally responsible teaching practices, mentorship, and more. And there's not one simple solution here. There's a lot that goes into it. Our guests have thought a lot about this. They put together a hardworking summit aimed at all of this. Dr. Jason Willis is Director of African American Studies at the Rochester City School District. Dr. Willis, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Also with us is Dr. Cecilia Golden, Deputy Superintendent of Teaching and Learning at the Rochester City School District. Dr. Golden, welcome back to you.
Good afternoon.
Dr. Sean Nelms is Superintendent of East High and Associate Professor at the Warner School of Education at the University of Rochester. Dr. Nelms, welcome back to you.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
And Dr. Leonard Brock, Director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Dr. Brock, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
I said before the hour began that we were going to get recent news out of the way early, because what we're going to focus this hour on is the question of educating young men and boys of color, hurdles and ways to create solutions in our district. And one question that is going to come up in our community is whether we are seeing too much turnover at the top, if it's impacting teachers, if it's impacting students. We know now there will be another new superintendent. There's been four in the last 10 years. If you count interims, seven in the last 10 years. And I wonder, Dr. Willis, if that's going to make it harder for you to do your job, harder for students, harder for teachers, or is that just sort of part of the process here?
Well, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to address this very early in the conversation, Evan.
We'll get that out of the way.
For me, I am a little bit green, and so this is my first time through turnover, though I recognize professionally that it creates many systemic potential hurdles. The one thing that I'm sure about is that we do have people in position in Rochester City School District who are capable of continuing to move the needle forward and march on behalf of children. And so I'm excited to work underneath the umbrella of the Deputy Superintendent, Dr. Cecilia Golden, and just excited about the work that's before me, knowing that there's plenty more work to do.
Okay. Superintendent Nelms, whether you want me to acknowledge this or not, I hear a lot of people bring your name up in the mix for future superintendents. You're looking at me with a big smile, like, of course you're going to say it. I want to know if you're interested, and I want to know if you think that this is a problem for the district or if it's an opportunity.
You know, I think that every transition provides an opportunity to refocus and shape the work ahead. I believe that we're in a unique time in which the community can define what the priorities are and the goals that they seek to attain, and then picking the right superintendent should be aligned to those identified goals and values. So I think the district has about 9 or 10 months to figure out what they value and the type of leader they want to have lead that work. But I think it's critical that the community define what the work is before selecting the next candidate.
Is it flattering to you to at least hear your colleagues talk about you in a way that says they respect your leadership?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, any time you're considered for a job of this importance, it's flattering. It's also an acknowledgement of the work that we've done and the work that we seek to do. But I think that, you know, it's more than just a person in that position. It's an entire team. It's a collaborative effort with the board. And again, it reflects the values of the community. And I think the work we're doing at East reflects the values of the community and the work we're doing in the community. I think that the city school district's position is something that we all think about in the leadership. I can't think of any leader in the county that would not be drawn to the opportunity to help change what's happening in the city, to improve what's happening in this community, and to make and redefine Rochester nationally. I think any leader who's in this position that I'm in should be thinking about doing that.
Okay. Dr. Golden, did the announcement from Superintendent Barberdine Williams, did it disappoint you at all? Does it worry you? Or again, I wonder if you see it as an open door.
I'm certainly disappointed that the superintendent has decided to retire. I don't think I'm worried. I'm a school-centric person, which I believe the superintendent is as well. I say and believe that if nothing changes in the classroom, nothing changes. So I focus at the place where teachers and school administrators reside. A change in superintendency certainly will have an impact, but I do not believe it will negatively impact what goes on in the schools on a daily basis.
All right. So I'm sure there'll be a lot more to say about that in the months to come. So let's set that aside now. And let me bring it back to Dr. Willis and start right here with what's going on this weekend and what the focus is. So why don't you tell our audience how this came together, Dr. Willis, and then if they want to still get involved, how they can do that.
Certainly. I received a call roughly 2 months ago from a friend of mine who's a Rochester native and who is just intimately concerned about what's going on with the plight of young people in Rochester, specifically our young boys. She runs a national organization, Madam C.J. Walker Legacy, Miss Natalie Cofield. But she wanted to do something specifically for young boys here in Rochester. And having boots on the ground, specifically underneath the umbrella of African-American studies within the Rochester City School District, I knew I had the touches and I knew I had the ability to be able to do some of the things that we both envisioned. What was really a blessing for me is that when I made the phone calls and I called people that I have relationships with, that I value as friends, that I really believe have student-first pedagogy mind states embedded in their day-to-day work process and in their lives, to a woman, each was able to show up for this date, which is very unique for me. Even Dr. Nelms, tucked before his trip to Israel, is making time. And, you know, we have a community issue going on right now, right? The state of our young people in the city of Rochester is something that we should all be concerned about. And what I want to do, A, is capture that energy in the room that day, provide positive opportunities for mentorship, have young folks and administrators, faculty, teachers see the veneer of young brothers of color that are already in positions and that have the ability to make things better for children. Lastly, you know, we can go to www.rocbmocsummit.splashthat.com. And you can register there, free for the community. We still have plenty of spaces open, so feel free to come on down on Saturday. 5257 West Henrietta Road, RIT Inn and Convention Center, Inn and Conference Center, excuse me. So we're excited about the program on Saturday.
All right, and for listeners who just heard the website, we'll make sure we post it on our various platforms if you want to check out the registration form. It is on Saturday. And before the program began, another important point that I think we should probably keep hitting is crisis is probably not too strong a word for the situation for boys and young men of color in terms of educational fulfillment, graduation, et cetera. However, there's a number you often hear trotted out in this community, and it's wrong. You often hear 9 or 10% of young men of color graduate from high school in the Rochester City School District. And Dr. Brock was just explaining before the program began that number is wrong. The number isn't what anybody wants it to be, but it's not 9% or 10%.
That is correct. The SHOP report in 2012 issued a report in which the 9% African-American males and 11% Hispanic males, that was cited as the graduation rates. There was a correction made by the SHOP report, provided the inaccurate information or the narrative that was shared across the community. And I think there were district officials and professionals that clarified that data. But the point being made that there is a crisis is still something that is very prominent and prevalent as it relates to the work in which we're attempting to do or address with the summit. Even with the correction, I want to say Rochester was one of the communities that have the least or had the least graduation rate amongst African-American males in the country. So even with the correction, it did not necessarily improve
the standing
or the narrative that Rochester is in dire need of support.
And what is the number? I mean, it's roughly what, high 20s, something like that?
I think at this point, I wouldn't be the best person to speak to that, especially considering that this was a correction made to the 2012 report.
Okay, fair enough. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but just listeners, if you hear 8%, 9%, 10%, that's not true. It's still a problem. So let's do this. Let's ask all of our guests to share their insight into why they think that's happening here. And then we'll talk specifically about what's coming up at the summit. And as we go throughout the program, if you want to communicate with us, as we're talking about educational opportunities and success for young men and boys of color, especially in the Rochester City School District, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Dr. Nelms, there's not one simple single reason, but when we talk about low graduation rates for young men of color, what stands out? Why is this happening?
Well, I can speak about my most recent experience with the East High Project in partnership with the University of Rochester. And we began that project by surveying the community, the parents, the students, and the staff to identify some of the academic and social barriers that existed for all of our students, particularly our students of color. And what students said is that there is a disconnect between those in authority and them as they move and navigate through through high school and through middle school. And so we restructured our school to provide adequate socio-emotional support through counselors and social workers and community organizations that allowed us to restore relationships among the adults in the system and how they interact with students. So step one was to make school an inviting place socially and emotionally for students. And then step two was to redesign curriculum in ways that engage students so they saw themselves as relevant in the materials, and also allowed them to have meaningful discourse between themselves and between them and the staff as they navigated through this very tough and rigorous curriculum. So what we realized is that the work wasn't too hard. The kids didn't feel connected to or engaged in the way in which it was being presented, so we addressed that. They didn't want to be in an environment where there were fights and violence and chaos. And so we restructured that to have the adults think about how they engage with students more meaningfully and not from an authoritative, dictatorial perspective. And then we were very responsive to the parents in the system to make them authentic partners in our work, meaning when they came to school, they were treated as not just the customer, but as those who are driving what we should be doing. I think that, coupled with organizations that in the community, like our MAPI, Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative that Dr. Brock leads, extending our presence on the University of Rochester's campus, as well as working with our community organizations like NEED and Connected Communities, really created an umbrella of support around East so that we had more of a community school-based focus. Where I see a huge disconnect in our system is often the voices of students and parents aren't authentically heard, and they don't shape and change the way in which we service them. And that's to me, is very problematic. And I think it's something that we've done well at East, and we continue to learn from, and lessons that we hope to share through the research we're doing at the Center for Urban Education Success at the University of Rochester.
How quickly do you realistically think you can see changes in, for example, just take the graduation rate? How is it year to year? Does it take five realistically? Does it take more?
I think there are short-term and long-term goals. I think short-term, you can see graduation rates change within 2 years, at least the trajectory. I think long-term, you can see them sustain over about 4 or 5 years. So when we entered the project, the graduation rate the previous year was 33.3%. By January of our first year, it was trending at 19% at East. By the end of that year, we got it to 40, end of that year meaning August graduation, and our most recent graduation number is 61%. So we nearly improved our graduation rate by 28 percentage points, which I think is not unheard of if you have the right systems and structures that respond to what students, parents, community, and staff demand. A lot of that work was done by empowering teachers to, again, redesign curriculum, to instruct it in ways that's meaningful to themselves and to the students, and to take the pressure of standardized tests off the table. We know that's a measure of success, but the work that we've done in trying to predict our trajectories has been much more meaningful data to use within a school. So I don't think the graduation issue is problematic. I think sustaining it becomes the next challenge. And that's the work that we're doing now and trying to create a model that hopefully is being used, replicated, or modified in other school systems. And I'm excited. There are school systems that are all from all over the country that have reached out to ask what we're doing and to see how they could modify it and revise it based on their own local context. So East is a school within Rochester. It has its own context. And I think that the changes in which that occurred there was based on information we got from that context. I think those things can be and should be replicated across not just Rochester, but across the state. And that was the intent of this program. I mean, East was a school that had failed. And this project was to incubate and to find out how we could redesign the school system in meaningful ways that could be replicated or modified throughout the city.
One more point before I turn to your colleagues, because I think this really deserves a little more stress and emphasis, which is when you say what you discovered was it wasn't the work was too rigorous,
right.
Is that it was sort of irrelevant to the students. At least I think I'm hearing you correctly.
Yes.
And in my own mind, I can try to figure out what that means, and I've got some assumptions. Mm-hmm. Can you be a little more specific about what you mean?
So I think there's a couple things. So in high-performing districts, suburban schools or high-performing urban settings, you have what we call viable curriculum. So it's curriculum that is scaffolded from pre-K to 12. So when the student enters pre-K or kindergarten, there's a roadmap, an academic roadmap that's laid out for them. At East, that roadmap was non-existent. There wasn't a viable curriculum. So we could not, when we walked in, I couldn't determine what was taught in English 1 that would be revisited in English 2 that would be mastered in English 3. So we had to redesign and write all of that curriculum from scratch with our staff or to use existing curriculum and modify it based on what the students said they needed. So it was more of a teacher problem than it was more of a systems problem than it was a kid problem. So first, the system didn't have curriculum. The teachers didn't have a system they could actually adopt or implement in their classroom. Therefore, the students were just kind of, you know, I could not guarantee any parent when they enter sixth grade and their kids graduated in 12th grade that they would have a consistent experience 6 through 12. It was teacher dependent. It was too chaotic. And so the first thing we did the first 3 years was to create a viable curriculum that would guarantee parents when they enter sixth grade and their kid leaves in 12th grade that they would have a very consistent and similar experience to the kids in the room next door. The teachers would tell you that was probably the greatest change that they have ever experienced because they helped write the curriculum. It forced them to open their doors and work collaboratively instead of in silos and allowed them to make revisions collectively. So the work was tough at first. But now it's at a point where they're in revision stages, and students have a voice in that revision stage saying, we didn't like this book, but we like this one better. This book was difficult, but the themes didn't make sense. So kids have authentic voice. Teachers are bringing their expertise and creativity to the table. But it directly aligns to what teachers and students told us when we did the pre-assessment before the EPO was implemented. So to me, I would say whoever comes into Rochester as superintendent next must focus on a viable curriculum that's guaranteed for parents pre-K through 12, that's embraced and developed by our teachers and with our teachers. If someone doesn't do that, we'll be having the same conversation 5 years from now.
Dr. Golden, as the Deputy Superintendent of Teaching and Learning, can you add to that? Do you agree with Dr. Nelms there?
The importance of culturally responsive curriculum cannot be overstated. The disconnect that many of our students have, male and female, I believe is a real source of why the academic achievement is what it is. We have already begun. I've been back to the district for 12 weeks. And while to develop curriculum is a long, arduous process, what we have done is developed learning objectives by grade and by subject area, pre-K through 12, which is in the hands of all teachers right now. When we talk about what makes the realities that we see with our African American males, Dr. Nelms is right. It is a disconnect. It's a disconnect relationship-wise, and it's a disconnect with what it is they're learning. We have to transform our schools to be much more culturally relevant. Curriculum, culture, climate. And if we don't do that, our boys will continue to be disengaged. It begins in the elementary, the primary grades. So when they get to East High School, it's really embedded within them that, one, they don't belong, that what they know doesn't matter, that who they are doesn't have a place in the school. So we have to look at what we call epistemology, what it is that students know and why do they know it, and the ontology of them, who they are culturally, what are their expectations, what is their worldview, and do we deliberately plan to engage in the discourse that matters to them. So if I'm a young black male in society right now, and I'm either watching the news and seeing what's happening societally, or I've got family members who have had negative experiences either in the economic world or in the law enforcement world, and I don't have a place to talk about that, then it just, I just continue to go into a shell, and I'm not really thinking about learning what one has to teach me. I need to be able to share what's going on with me. So that's a long, I think, answer to your question, but I cannot say it enough that we have to figure out how to transform our urban schools to ensure that our children are learning at high levels, and that absolutely includes meaningful professional development for the teachers who teach them and the school administrators who lead the schools.
Okay, Dr. Willis?
Really a great way to segue back to the event. You know, this event is open to teachers, and so when Dr. Nelms talks about empowering teachers, we see Saturday as an opportunity to do just that. 200 teacher spots have been reserved. Over 154 teachers will be in the building. We're talking about education for our young boys and men of color, and we'll have teachers in the room, right? Paramount. We also know that we hear a lot of rhetoric about the State Department and what levels they are supportive. We received a call, and the State Department is going to be a part of the program because they heard about it and they care about Rochester, and they recognize that there are some things going on that put us in this very unique picture. A city that has resources, a city who has disparate statistics, truncated in populations of folks, specifically young boys of color. So the state will be in the room, the teachers will be in the room, the parents will be in the room, the services will be in the room, the young gentlemen with the professional veneers that mirror the population of young folks we're hoping to affect will be in the room. We also have been blessed to receive support through Dr. Ershad Altimer and Dr. John Clofus for the Center for Public Safety Initiatives, who's going to take the survey instrument that we have that day and evaluate it, write a free paper for the community. Dr. Patterson at Georgetown has sat down, and we're discussing ways in which we can capture energy in that room and really do something that's foundational and continue moving the needle forward. We want our young ladies to know and our community ladies to know we're doing the exact same thing for females in 6 months from now. This just happens to be the kickoff, but we're coming back and we're making sure that we lay down the foundation to keep revisiting these issues because they haven't gone anywhere, and unless we really begin to be serious with actions, they're not going anywhere.
Let me also ask, and maybe I'll direct this to Dr. Brock first. I have this, you know, sort of, we have this rotating conversation about the impact of poverty on education, and there's a bit of a chicken and egg conversation now. As someone who's the director of the Anti-Poverty Initiative, I hear from listeners all the time who say, Evan, you can try this reform, you can try that reform, but until you fix poverty, none of this is really going to get fixed overall. And yet, what I'm hearing from Dr. Nelms, Dr. Golden, Dr. Willis, are ideas that do seek to work to reform and make change, even while still living in a world with the really powerful effect of poverty that we have. Do you disagree with listeners who say, if you don't fix poverty first, none of this will make that much difference?
I think the chicken and egg conversation will continue to happen. However, there is a strong correlation between education and poverty. But because a person lives in poverty does not mean that they cannot be educated and we cannot provide the supports for them to be successful. At one point, the community had a hard time fighting high poverty school districts that were successful. But we have models across the country. When you look at the work of Union City, New Jersey, which is a high poverty school district that has a graduation rate that's hovering close to 80%. And when they started 13 years ago, it was closer to 50%. So that's an example of one high poverty school district that is doing extremely well. And it almost mirrors the demographics of the city, the Rochester City School District. You look at the work in Kentucky and the work in Cincinnati and those communities that have a collective impact framework that is being modeled in Rochester with Rock the Future, as well as our MAPI. Those communities are doing extremely well. And they too have high poverty school districts. You look at the work that's taking place in Portland, San Diego. Those are communities that have high poverty school districts that are starting to see and realize positive change in the academic context. So the argument that in order for educational outcomes to improve, we have to address the poverty problem, the two are correlated, but one does not equate the other.
Okay. Dr. Golden, you're nodding. You agree with that?
Absolutely. Correlation does not mean cause and effect. And I think we need to make that distinction. So what happens in school districts where poverty is a factor? When you look at the schools, you have to ask the question, do you find in, within those schools the same as you find in more affluent schools in terms of materials, equipment, quality teachers, all of that? So we really have to look not at the children, but at the system in which they live.
All right, the conversation this hour is about an upcoming summit. You just heard Jason Willis mention. Dr. Willis is Director of African American Studies at the Rochester City School District, and the event is the Boys and Men of Color Education Summit this Saturday, the 27th of October, starting at 8 a.m. at the RIT Inn and Convention Center. And there's still opportunities for those in the community who want to attend. After our only break of the hour, we'll come back and remind you, when Dr. Willis says there's open space, do you want students there? Do you want more parents there? Do you want more teachers there? So we're going to talk about who else it's aimed at if there's still open space. So if you want to jump online, we'll put on our various platforms an opportunity for you to do so. I'll read some of the feedback we've been getting, and we continued the conversation about educational opportunity and success for young men and boys of color, especially in RCSD. That's next. Coming up in our second hour, we invite all candidates for governor to join us on Connections before the election and after they officially declare their candidacies. You've heard from the Libertarian and the Green Party candidate. Today, it's independent candidate Stephanie Miner. She's a Democrat who served as the mayor of Syracuse for 8 years after term limits required her to leave that office. Now she wants to be governor. We'll talk to Stephanie Miner next hour about her plans for Albany. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Andrew emails the program to say, Evan, your guests are saying that much of the educational material for young black men is not relevant to them, not to their lives, not to their cultures. At least that's the way I'm hearing it. But you have black men on your panel who assumedly went to school, maybe in Rochester, I don't know where they grew up, graduated and succeeded in spite of that. Can they address that disparity? That's from Andrew. Okay, Andrew, thank you. Dr. Brock, you want to start?
Sure. We're talking about the exception to the rule. When I actually graduated from the city school district, I was actually ill prepared. I did attend the University of Buffalo, and much of the lived experience did allow for me to navigate the college experience. But I will say that people often use that argument. If one person did it, then everyone can do it. They use the exception as if it's the rule, when in reality, structurally, systemically, there is a significant amount of work that needs to happen in order to ensure that there are other individuals that may have the experience. And when often asked the question, what happened that allowed for you to be successful, so many, let's say, others not to be successful? And if I were to be 100% candid, I would say I just didn't get caught. It's not that I wasn't exposed or things couldn't change and I could have actually went left as opposed to right. But the reality is I'm one of many Dr. Brocks in our community that do not have the nurturing, the nourishing, that do not have the support. And I'm even written off as a professional. And just imagine those young persons who do aspire to be a Dr. Brock, a Dr. Willis, a Dr. Nelms. What obstacles we had to overcome in order to be where we are. So it's one thing to see the outcome, but it's another to understand the process it took for us to be here and so many others that didn't, they weren't able to make it through that particular trajectory.
Yeah, I can't tell you. I echo those sentiments completely. I would also say that my spirit wasn't prepared. My cultural identity wasn't prepared when I moved and when I went to college. Even though I'm a Rochester native, even though I went to SUNY Brockport, there were pieces of my spirit that were absent, right? I never had an African-American male teacher. I never had exposure to Crispus Attucks or Benjamin Banneker or methodologies behind ancient African civilizations that has sustainability over thousands of years. We could teach our young folks Fertile Crescent in ancient Mesopotamia, or we could teach our young folks Fertile Crescent for Nile River civilization. Grounds, you know, well to harvest for crops, people, cultural diffusion and transmission of information, so on and so forth. So, you know, we just need to be careful as educators, right, how it is that we protect the spirits of our young folks and give them the broadest base that they can possibly have in order to effectively navigate those things that we already know are in place to set them back or to filter them out.
Okay, Dr. Nelms?
It's interesting. In 1902, Dr. Cooley introduced this concept called the looking glass self theory. Mm. And it's development of oneself and one's identity through one's interpersonal interactions with the context of society. And I think that, you know, it's one place to navigate and be successful in society and still not see yourself as part of that society. And I know when I've spoken with Dr. Willis and Dr. Brock in personal conversations, we both experience that even as professionals, that we question if society really accepts us as part of that society or if we are the exception. I took my children to go see The Hate U Give this past weekend. And within that movie, you see the main character, Star, try to navigate to see which society she fits in. And so not only do we have struggles with students of color who are in poverty, but even when they make it, society may not be ready for their success. And so this weekend's conversation will not only give students and teachers and the community the pathway, a pathway towards academic and social success, but it'll also allow them to be around individuals who are still seeking their self-identity in society, even as adults. And often our energy comes from kids navigating those same challenges. And it puts a pressure on those adults in a room to be articulate and be passionate and be persistent about redefining the identity that society expects of us and from us. So I'm constantly thinking about how do I learn from the youth so that they're not in their 40s and 50s still seeking identity within this society. Because there's so many faces and masks we have to wear. We were talking about this off the air. There are days you walk through society and you have a face of a husband, a father, Dr. Nelms, the people you grew up with in your community, the folks who see you in a newspaper who really don't understand you, the people who truly understand you. And sometimes you forget which face you're wearing. And so as we convene this week and we talk about how leaders can launch boys and men of color into being into their next phase of their lives, self-identity and societal identity becomes really important. And I'm excited that this weekend will provide these young folks, as well as the older individuals, an opportunity to start redefining their own self-identity, but more importantly, to have society understand who our identities are without us jeopardizing or changing them for society.
Dr. Willis, if there are open seats, who do you want to fill those seats?
Everyone that has a vested interest in what's going on, state of affairs. If you have an idea, you think you know how to fix the problem, we want you to parking lot that idea because we want to make sure that the energy that we capture in that room is part of the collective conscious. Mm. It's all of us in the rock talking about the rock and the kids that are going to the school systems in the rock because we love the rock. Right. And everybody there is there pro bono, with the exception of Dr. Patterson, who's been gracious enough to come from Georgetown University. So I just say, you know, these are people who are in positions to have touches on the lives of children, to make very actionable items for children. I trust these brothers that I know are representative on this panel and on all of these panels and throughout this program. I call these people personally because we already have a relationship. And I'm thankful for their relationship, and I'm thankful for them stepping up. If I may, I'm incredibly thankful to Endless Highways, First Capital Payments and Processing, Rochester Community Foundation, Starbridge Parent Alignment, and Platinum Auto World for their support throughout the course of this venture.
I couldn't help but notice, Dr. Brock, you said that even now, in your professional life, you know, you were trying to be, I think, as straight with us as you could be about your background,
right,
the path in life. But even now, you can be dismissed as in your professional setting?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that sense of self-concept is something I'm very aware as an individual, but I'm also cognizant that others may not necessarily perceive me the way I perceive myself. And I give you three examples. People may see me in different contexts and think that either I'm aggressive or I am volatile, hostile, because I'm not necessarily forceful, because I am assertive as it relates to just using information, data. Second is individuals may dismiss you because they feel like the only way that you're in a room is because you are on a tokenized assignment to get something done versus appreciation for the qualities and the qualifications and, you know, your value add to the context and what it is. And then third, we're still rarities in the rooms in which we occupy. So it's very common for me to be the only African-American male in a room, and I oftentimes have to speak 2, 3, 4 times in order to get one point across, when in reality, that's not the same courtesy that's given to others. And that's just
A couple of pieces.
Everyone in this room, when you said that there are times where you feel like the room assumes you are there because you're an African-American, not because of your skills.
Exactly.
Everyone in this room was nodding. Have you all experienced and felt that?
On a regular basis.
Yes.
You know, it's a part of a conditioning, right? No one would step into your office and assume that you haven't been prepared, that you're not the best guy for this job. And we as a Rasta community salute you. You are the best guy for this job. There are many people that tap in this program because of the spirit that you bring and the even keel, but you're the best guy for this job. You don't have to get challenged in that chair. Oftentimes in professional paradigms, wherever I go, specifically under the umbrella of African-American studies, you have to fight those challenges. And many of them are cerebral. So because there's been layers of conditioning over time and space, one's mental state must filter everything that's calibrating in a moment, all of those lenses, all of those personalities or epistemologies, ontologies that are a part of your presence and your being. And you just want to help kids. You just want to love children. You just want people to do their best in their occupation for kids, right?
A person once made reference, and I'm not saying that this is right or wrong. They said, you don't have the privilege to have an opinion, but you have an opportunity and responsibility to use data. And I didn't understand what they meant. They said, if you have an opinion in these spaces, oftentimes you will be dismissed because people don't see you as an African-American male who's educated, as having the right information. But if you use data to equip your argument, people will have more of an understanding and an appreciation for you and what you have to say versus you having an opinion. And I argue with that within myself for quite some time, but I know it to be true.
So think about children, right? So we're grown. We've got coping mechanisms. We've got the experience to, you know how to, quote, play the game. We know when we're dealing with some adversarial
energies,
mm-hmm. Right. But think about children who aren't given the opportunity to express opinions, right, without someone thinking that they're challenging authority. Think about children who, because of the ways in which the curriculum may be, or the pedagogical practices may be, or the disconnect in the books that are being written, that the child then doesn't do well and then has, quote, failed. And no one asks the question, has the child failed the system or has the system failed the child? So what happens then is many of our black males and some black females are being retained in grade, right? When we know that the vast majority of students that drop out have been retained earlier on in their academic programming. So these are the kinds of things that I have to look at and have wanted to, and to switch. The struggle shouldn't be this hard in 2018 for these African-American males sitting around the table and those who are not sitting around the table, and the African-American males and females in our schools today. That's our work, right? That's the work that we have before us.
No question.
I would say that absolutely. I think there are numbers and numbers of students who go through school pre-K through 12 without any validation or affirmation of their intellectual ability. They may be affirmed for being compliant, not misbehaving, but for their intellectual ability. And I think when Brock said there are tons of Dr. Brocks in the community who weren't nurtured, what he's saying is there are people who are intellectually as gifted, if not more gifted than he, but they didn't have the pathways laid before them. And I know your phone's going to blow up because it's a question we always get. What about the parents? And so I'm going to answer it this way because I know it's probably – I'm going to say this. I really shifted in my work these last few years. Instead of asking what's wrong with kids and parents to what happened, we have to remember that many of our parents went through this same broken system. And so they don't have faith in the system in which they're sending their own child. And they don't have the ability to move those children to a more promising academic environment. So the cycle just continues. And so we have very, very, very dedicated parents who are skeptical of a system that failed them and their spouse and their siblings. And so there is a cultural retooling that has to take place. I believe this summit, this weekend, is one of many opportunities to retool and to redefine how we engage one another, how we forcefully engage the system. You know, I think gone are the days in which we get parents together and we say to them, we want you to go after this issue. We organize you to go after this issue. That has to shift. Parents should be organizing the school system to go after this issue. So we shouldn't organize people based on what we think should happen. We should be organized in a way that reflects the community's demand. And I believe that's what we started at East by starting our program by asking the parents and students and staff, what do you want in a school system? And then align that with best practice throughout the nation.
Part of this is also, you know, I know we spoke a few months ago when I was here. This is part of the needs assessment. What does the community need? When we're able to evaluate this data as the individual of director of African American Studies for Rochester City School District, I will have a very clear understanding of on that day and those people that were in the room, what was the prioritization of the voice? What were the actionable items? I think that I just think that we have a responsibility to do all that we can to make sure and to ensure that, one, we fix our love language in our community. Our love language is broken, and it's hurting us. The way we communicate with each other, the suburbs to the urban to the urban, the rural, our greater Rochester community, our love language as people is broken. The second thing is we need to recognize trauma in the same way we recognize trauma for everybody else who experiences trauma. We talk about individuals who might have experienced something in their life and now they're depressed. Trauma sounds differently. When we talk about our soldiers that go and fight in a different country, and many of our kids fight in a different country just coming into a school building because it's not the standard operating procedures that are immersed in the urban motif, right? They hear gunshot soldiers, and we recognize that our young folks do 100 times more than the national average here in Rochester, New York. Right? Our young ladies, 1 in 5 before age 18, is at some level physically or sexually assaulted, and that's just reported cases. So if we're going to turn our ears up for all types of trauma, let's be very, very acutely aware of the level of trauma on a day-to-day basis that our young kings and queens are experiencing as children, not as fully equipped, totally prepared, well-balanced, fully calibrated, emotional filters. Our kids have like two emotional filters, like video games, basketball and music that they utilize, and the other one is tears, but many people don't see it as such. Right?
Dr. Wilson, you know, one of the things that I often hear is, you know, children would be persistent. Kids in the city are persistent. And resilient. Mm-hmm. I always breathe like a good like 2 seconds and say, a 13-year-old isn't supposed to be resilient.
Right.
They're supposed to enjoy life.
Yes.
Right? And we somehow have made resiliency and persistence a quality that's special. Resilience and persistence is a response to hurt.
Yes.
And our kids are hurting.
Friction.
And so we have to, this summit again provides an opportunity. And I want to let Dr. Brock jump in because I heard him talk about this often. I don't want a community of persistent and resilient students.
No children.
Question. Children. Mm-hmm. I want a community in which kids can learn and grow and be adventurous and be prepared to leave high school and pursue their dreams.
And know that they were loved the whole way along.
By the community.
No doubt.
All of the community, not just those in the community that look like them.
And the only thing I was going to add to that without anything that was already said was that's part of the exception. Those of us in this room, we are very resilient. We are very persistent. We've demonstrated grit time and time again. And more importantly, we demonstrate resilience, grit, and persistence even now in our occupations.
Absolutely.
So if that is the expectation that everyone will have that grit, then we're setting ourselves up for a false narrative that we put responsibility on the individual versus looking at the system and the structures that need to change that support the individuals. Mm-hmm. So that's the question or the argument or the statement that was raised earlier in terms of the exception. You have a Dr. Willis and a Dr. Nelms and a Dr. Brock. If y'all did it, everybody should be able to do it. So what? Everybody should be resilient. Everybody should have grit. Everyone should be persistent. And if that's the expectation, then
how do we cultivate all those characteristics in individuals in real time while also having them be able to produce with outcome-based measures? You know, I mean, we have master teaching, right? We need master educating. We need the ability to reach the child where they're at in their experience. And if it's the arc, we teach the arc of a jump shot, and then we take them to Mount Hope Bridge, and we teach the science behind the stability of an arc. You know, we do it within the context of the things that are palpable for our kids, that we know that they go to, that they turn to.
So let me just ask, in our remaining minutes, Dr. Willis brought up Crispus Attucks, if I recall correctly. I remember, so I went to a mostly white district outside Cleveland. Second grade, Miss Van Meter had me memorizing lines about Crispus Attucks, and yet I said last week on this program, I don't want to indict my school district, but I don't remember ever hearing the words Thurgood Marshall when I was in school. Mm-hmm. You know, my point is there's a lot of holes, number one, in education to begin with for all kids.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But then when you think about who's doing the educating, we've brought this up on the program before, but when Dr. Nelm says you got parents who don't trust the system, even if they, as Dr. Brock points out, even if they are the exception to the rule and they have sort of pushed beyond the boundaries that society sort of created, they still don't trust the system. Mm-hmm. And you're dealing with that. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's a good reminder to everybody that you do need representation in the classroom, in administrators, the higher up you go, you need it everywhere. And so are we any more optimistic today that we can attract and help cultivate more African-American men to teach?
I am optimistic that this community, and maybe it's because of the political environment that we're in, that this community is now opening their eyes and not conveniently hiding behind their lack of knowledge or ignorance. And in the past, you heard people say, well, I just didn't know, or I didn't understand, and you know, there had to be a reason. I mean, I think this political environment has really forced us all to open our eyes and have thoughtful conversations. This feels like a living room conversation. And this is what it used to be when we had communities, when people can have discourse and agree to disagree. You see, social media is actually bridging the geographic boundaries that exist. You know, when I'm arguing on Facebook or Twitter, it's with people from all over this county and this country. That's a good thing if it's done respectfully. So I'm optimistic that we have teachers who no longer can ignore the realities of our students and their requirement to make sure we are serving kids meaningfully. That no longer can be ignored. And I think with that, as we graduate more men of color from high schools, then we'll have more men of color who might choose to enter the field of education.
And just to throw out a plug, I actually graduated from East. And there was a very effective program that still exists today, the Teaching and Learning Institute. And the primary person for TLI was to help cultivate teachers of color. And me being one of the first graduates of TLI, and the Delahantes are doing a really great job. Absolutely. Even to this day. Mm-hmm. So although I wasn't as prepared as I needed to be, had I not went through the TLI program, I probably wouldn't have been accepted into college, let alone prepared. Mm-hmm. To participate at, you know, with the level of rigor that college provided. So there are programs, there are some pockets of success. And in TLI, I just have to throw that plug out there because I am a TLI grad, I'm an Eastside grad. And that encouraged me, even though I didn't take the traditional teaching route. I do consider myself an educator in some sense of the word.
All right. Dr. Golden, you want to add to that?
I just wanted to say, go back to what you said about the curriculum needing to be more comprehensive for all children, for all students. I'm advocating that it is reflective of the truth, not omitting stories or omitting different people in history, inventors, writers, authors, but make it a comprehensive curriculum that reflects a more truthful societal contributions, right? Contributions from everyone. And I think that everybody will benefit because I don't believe many of our teachers have learned some of the things that you just mentioned, Evan and Dr. Willis, that they haven't learned themselves. It hasn't been part of their high school curriculum, nor has it been part of their pre-service in college. So the challenge for us is to make sure that teachers know and understand more fully what the historical context is.
Well, it's been a remarkable conversation this hour, and I know they've got a big day planned for Saturday. There's still seats and slots available, I should say. So this Saturday, starting at 8 a.m. at the RIT Inn and Convention Center, is the Boys and Men of Color Education Summit. And we're going to post links so you can not only check out information about what's coming your way on Saturday with that, but also for registration and for attendance, because there are still some spaces if you want to be there. Dr. Jason Willis has helped put it together, Director of African American Studies for RCSD. Great having you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Appreciate you guys.
Dr. Cecilia Golden, Deputy Superintendent of Teaching and Learning for the Rochester City School District. Very good having you. Thank you very much. Dr. Leonard Brock, Director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Thank you, Dr. Brock.
Thank you.
And Dr. Sean Nelms, Superintendent of East. Nice having you back here. Thanks.
Always a pleasure, Evan.
All right. Thank you. Short break. More connections coming up.